Okay. This is our last time meeting together in our spring semester. And then we take a break and we'll be back at it September, Lord willing. The plan is to continue on in Isaiah because we will not get done tonight, believe it or not. We're picking up in Isaiah chapter 15, if you want to turn there. So the Girls of Grace are continuing on for a while. It will be in a bulletin. I'm thinking maybe it's the 17th of May. I'm not sure. But that will certainly be known and made known in regards to that. So, again, picking up in chapter 15 of Isaiah, and what we have in front of us from chapter 13 to chapter 23 is the fact that God is at work in the nations of the world. Some of what we come across is going to be prophecy because Isaiah, who's here, he's speaking about things that are coming up in this aspect of judgment that's going to come upon Judah, but there's some ramifications to Israel, the northern kingdom. But there are some aspects of it that are also future. They're millennial. And we've talked about the millennium as well. And so, again, it kind of comes back to the fact that some of these things are somewhat of double fulfillment, double prophecy. Some of them really can only be fulfilled in the millennial period. And so what we, as we pick up in chapter 13 and go on to chapter 23, God is speaking against particularly 10 Gentile nations that judgment is coming, and the reason is because they've rejected him. In Daniel chapter 4, verse 25, we read this as Daniel is talking to Nebuchadnezzar. Remember, he got proud and all of this. And Daniel said this, that you will know that the Most High rule, or actually Nebuchadnezzar, the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he wishes. You know, God is the one who raises individuals up and he takes them down. And in leadership positions, as presidents, as kings, in all of those particular areas. And so Daniel 4:25, the most High rules. We live in a world that has been influenced, has been corrupted, is probably a better way than just influenced, who's been corrupted by evil and by sin. And we've looked at that. Romans speaks about it. That's why we see the atrocities and we hear about the atrocities that take place within our world. In Acts 17:26, a reference there in Acts 17, that God determines the time for the nations and the exact places where they should live, which is really, really interesting. That God has the exact places for those who, the nations, kingdoms, etc., they're brought up, they're taken down, but God has the exact, he determines how much area and how much that they will control. And so when we look through these prophecies, they're prophecies from Isaiah's viewpoint, but from our perspective, we're looking back on things that have already happened. So, but to see that these are being fulfilled as God predicted tells us that God is in control. Because if not, you can't make prophecy. Or you say, well, we hope this is going to happen. So some of the, we've worked our way through some of these individual, these nations. The first one we talked about was back in chapter 13 and on into 14, which was Babylon, that God was going to judge Babylon. And then we looked at Assyria, and that God was going to judge Assyria. And then there was Philistia, last part of chapter 14. And then this evening we pick it up with Moab in chapter 15. So beginning then in chapter 15, there are four different ways in which, there are like 14 different ways in which the word lament is just used in chapter 15. And this is going to happen within a three-year timetable from Isaiah's prophecy. You see that over in chapter 16, verse 14. Jump ahead there just a moment. Chapter 16, verse 14. And now the Lord speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all of its great population. Its remnant will be very small. So from 15 on to chapter 16, these events are going to happen within 3 years of Isaiah's prophecy. Now, as What do you think it means? It says, as a hired man would count them. What does that mean?
They are supposed to be accountable.
Be accountable? What else? Hired man is wanting, yeah, waiting to go home, wanting it to be done soon. So when it says it's going to be done within so the time would be shorter rather than longer, you know. So picking up then in verse 15, and what we do see that Moab, look at it, verse, and the oracle concerning Moab, surely in the night, and we go through a number of these things. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. It's mourning that's going to come as a result of what takes place in Moab. Streets have girded themselves with sackcloth. Again, it's the idea of mourning.
Where are you reading from?
This is chapter 15 of Isaiah. Sorry, I jumped back.
You said 16.
I was 16 for 14, for verse 14.
Yeah,
okay, we'll reset. We jumped ahead to 16:14 for the aspect of a hired hand. Now we're back to chapter 15.
Which verse?
Take one. First one. And we're going to jump through it. We're not going to read each verse. Okay?
We were talking about beards. I think it threw everybody off.
Yeah, I don't see the beard.
That's in verse 2.
It's in verse 2. It's the end of verse 2. Last part of verse 2.
Got it?
All right, we did a reset. Hopefully we're in the same place now. Okay, sorry about that. You see in Moab is dead. Okay, we'll start in verse 1. All right, so let's get a run at this. All right, we good? Verse 1. Surely in a night of our Moab is devastated and ruined. So judgment's coming. Moab is devastated and ruined. Again, it's repeated, verse 1. They've gone up to the temple and even to the high places to weep. That's normally where you would go to celebrate. That's normally where you would go to worship and to kind of intercede with the gods. Last part of verse 2, Moab is wailing. Everyone's head is bald. Every beard is cut off. Again, in that day, if you recall, in 2 Samuel, when we looked at that, if you cut somebody's beard off, that was desecration. You know, it's not quite, well, it's worse than knocking somebody's hat off, but you know, so it was desecration. They've shaved their heads, their beards are cut off, they're in sackcloth, verse 3, and everyone is wailing and dissolved in tears because of what is coming. People have gone to the temples, they prayed to their gods, but it's useless. And so there's a day of national humiliation that is taking place. Armed men are there in Moab, down to verse 5. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar and Eglath, etc. Even with the fact that Moab is suffering for its sin, I find it interesting that in verse 5, you know, Isaiah is saying, my heart goes out to them, even for God's judgment. We'll come back to something like that in a little bit. We'll see it a little bit later in another place as well. Verse 6, waters of Nimrim are desolate, their grass is withered. You get to verse 7, therefore the abundance which they have acquired and stored up, they carry off after the brook of Arabim. And that's referring to the fact of invading armies that are going to be coming. So these are aspects of the event that God is superintending. And he's saying these are the things that are going to happen. Now, it's interesting to know that Moab and Israel were enemies. But do you remember how the nation of Moab got started? Pardon?
I just see Sodom and Gomorrah's place. Is that Lot's grandchildren?
Yeah. If you remember, Lot and his wife who lived in Sodom, okay, and God said judgment's going to fall, and they were to leave, and don't look back, and all of that. And Lot wife did look back. She lost her life. And so Lot and his two daughters went on. And they realized that they weren't going to be able to carry on the family name. And so if you remember, I mean, Lot and Abraham, you know, Abraham and Lot were related. Okay? So the daughters of Lot realized that they were not going to be able to carry on the family name. So the two daughters made this pact and said, I tell you what, let's get Dad drunk and you sleep with him tonight. And then you get him drunk tomorrow night and I'll sleep with him. I don't want to know.
I mean, because in my younger days, I've gotten drunk before. I don't believe that I have ever seen that much alcohol.
Well,
much less
drank. I don't know. Maybe it was 100 proof. I don't know. Yeah. Well, so daughters get pregnant, and as a result of that. You know, and then, but
his daughter's got pregnant.
But you still got to realize there's a lot of inbreeding that still has to happen. So that's how Moab gets started. So they were related to Israel.
Well, hold on. Now, if you go back farther than that, go back to Adam and Eve. That's a different story.
That's a little different. Genetics were 100%.
We're all inbred.
Well, yes, to a degree. We're all related.
Did his two daughters have kids with him?
Yeah. So, but the genetic pool was clean back with Adam and Eve. That was not a problem. You know, I mean, the question. So. Where did, you know, Cain and Abel, where did they get, you know, where did they get their wives? Their sisters.
Yeah.
You know? That's because we all related back to those Adam and Eve. Genetic pool is pure. You didn't have to worry about, you know, problems with the genetic line. It wasn't that God created a separate line. It's just, so it's really neat, you know, people ask thinking they're going to stump you. But it really is not. It's really an easy answer. And back then, I mean, they didn't think anything differently and didn't know anything differently, and it wasn't prohibited. So there were an option. Hand someplace.
Before we get too far into it, I'm curious about the perspective, the way Isaiah is speaking here in the early part of 15. He talks about the nation, and he goes from plural to singular, speaking of Moab as though an individual, which... it's not uncommon, you'll tell.
Right.
But when he describes the people wailing and lamenting, is that prophecy looking forward as though he's saying it as he's seeing it, or has he prophesied to the people and the people know it's coming and they are actually wailing at this time? So what's the perspective?
I think this is a prophecy that's going to happen, and that's why I confused you with 16:14, not intentionally. But, you know, within this 3-year period.
So the way it's written here.
Yeah.
It looks like he's saying the people are wailing now, but is he prophesying?
Yeah.
As though and, he's looking at the future and they're wailing and...
Yes. It's what's called a prophetic present. So it is so sure to happen that is presented as already happening. All right? And so the Assyrians are the ones who are going to come in against Moab, and that's what's spoken of here. And then in verse 9, for the waters of Dimon are full of blood, surely I will bring added woes upon Dimon, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab, upon the remnant of the land. So the water is going to be stained with blood. It's that the Assyrians were known as being a people that were very, they committed significant atrocities. That's just how they ruled by terror. And that's what they did. And so that's the first part. That's the plight, if you wanted to use that terminology, in verses 1 through 9. That's the plight of Moab that's there. Okay? Ready to move to 16? And then in 16, we read, send tribute to the Lamb, the ruler of the land, from Selah by way of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. And so what they're trying to do is, let's see if I think I've got a map here.
Assyria or Syria?
Assyria.
Assyria, okay.
Assyria. So, you know, this is eventually it's all the green is what it will be. But and so we see down here, the Assyrians are not able to conquer Judah. And you see that right here. Now they invade some of the territory, but they can't take it. God has protected Judah. There's no reason from a human perspective why Judah should still be in existence. They should have been wiped out. They should be part of the green.
It looks like today. It's the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much. You can go just a little bit bigger, but yes, God is protecting Israel. And so, though they do create some havoc for Judah, yet Judah in and of itself will maintain its sovereignty. Remember Israel's northern 10 tribes, they fall under Assyrian rule. And that's what Isaiah is prophesying. They're going to be carried off. And so, pick it up then. They send tribute to the Lamb, to the ruler of the land, from the Salem. So they want the king of Judah to respond. So they're going to send some tribute. Moab is going to send some tribute. They want the king of Judah, Jerusalem, southern tribe, to kind of help protect them against all of this, since they seem to be able to stand. So that we're going to send tribute, we're going to send some animals and etc. So that's verse 1. Then like a fleeing or scattered nestling, the daughters of Moab will gather at the fords of Arnon. Give us advice, make a decision, cast your shadow like at the night of noon, hide the outcast, do not betray the fugitives. This is Moab appealing to Judah for protection. All right? Okay? We're appealing to Judah for protection. Verse 4, let the outcasts of Moab stay with you. Be a hiding place to them from the destroyer. We want you, Judah, to protect us against the Assyrians. So they send animals, but then you look at verse 5. A throne will even be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it with faithfulness in the tent of David. That's Jerusalem. So the Moab is appealing to Judah, saying, we want your protection. We want you to watch over us. And then it's kind of, they wanted, and we'll get to this a little bit later on in chapter 16, but Judah says, no, we're not going to do that. And the reason is, you want our protection, but you don't want our God. So they're going to reject Moab. Moab's all again has been enemies with Judah, but if you don't want our God, you don't get our protection.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Today it's where was God when this happened? Where was God when that happened? It's like y'all haven't want anything to do with it.
Right.
You snub your nose at him, you mock him, you mock his children, and then you want to whine and complain, where was God?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. So Moab wanted deliverance on its own terms. And so we pick up in chapter 16, verse 6, where we find that Moab is very prideful. There's a lot of pride in Moab. Now, we can understand why there would be pride in a city like Babylon. Babylon was a very, very beautiful city. Moab is this little dinky country, and yet they have a lot of pride. And we see that around us today, don't we? You know, somebody who walks around with a big strut, and they haven't done anything to earn it. I've just seen little pieces. Indian Wells tennis tournament is going on. And I've seen little clips here and there of the tennis matches that are going. And there's this young buck, and this is what even the commentators are saying. He walks with a swagger that he hasn't earned. Now he looks like he's an up and comer, but I thought that was that's pretty insightful. He walks with a swagger that he hasn't earned.
Fake it till you make it.
What's that?
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, that's Moab. They've got the swagger they haven't earned. All right? So in verse 6, we've heard of the pride of Moab, excessive pride. Even of its arrogance, pride, and fury, his idle boasts are false. You know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And if you remember, you know, previously, one of the things, when we were back in chapter 14, if we understand that correctly, that it's a reference to Lucifer, you know, the first sin was pride. I will be like God. This pride deal is a big thing. It's not exactly tied to pride itself, I guess. But I saw someone, responding that, you know, you've embarrassed this young person with that kind of a response. You know, sometimes there's a need for embarrassment. Amen. You know, if you do something, that's, I think, part of learning. We aren't always going to, you know, endorse actions of people, and having some embarrassment is a good thing. It keeps us from doing stupid things again. But so Moab's got pride. And so we read then, they're going to wail, verse 7, they're going to wail, every one of Moab shall wail, you shall moan for the raisin cakes, you're going to like to what you used to have. The fields and the vines, verse 8, lords of the nations have trampled down its choice clusters. Moab used to have good fruit, it's going to be trampled down, which were reached as far as Jazer and wandered to the deserts, tendrils spread out. So, you know, they had this aspect that their influence spread. Verse 9, therefore I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the vine of Sibnah. I will drench you with the tears of Heshbon, for the shouting over. So judgment is coming. Verse 10, and gladness and joy are taken away. Again, that judgment aspect that's referenced there. No traitor. Verse 11, therefore my heart intones like a harp for Moab, and in my inward feelings. Here again, you know, back in verse 5, the heart goes out for the disaster on Moab. Here in verse 11, my heart goes out for the disaster that's going to happen on Moab. And so in verse 12, when Moab presents himself, wearies himself upon his high place, comes to the sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail. So they come on their own terms, the sanctuary of Jerusalem, they're going to come, and they're not going to have that opportunity because they're not willing to bow their knee before the Lord. This is the word of the Lord, verse 13, and it's going to happen within 3 years. Ezekiel 33, verse 11, God writes this, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked.
What was that reference
again? Ezekiel 33:11.
You said that?
That was Ezekiel, that's God speaking.
Okay, that's
God speaking. You know, and I was thinking that through, trying to think that through within the context of where we live. And if God doesn't delight, which he doesn't, all right, let me change it from rhetorical to a statement. Since God doesn't delight in the death of the wicked, what about us?
We shouldn't either, I guess.
You're right, Aaron. But you know, there are people that you know, they're on the other side of the fence. They continue to create all kinds of havoc, whether on a political divide, whatever they might be. God takes no... And sometimes the wicked have to be taken out.
Yeah.
Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when that happened, God didn't delight in it, but it needed to happen. It was justice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a sign of spiritual maturity that I've always been, I confess, a little envious of when... In a discussion, when a personality may arise that people are, especially on, you know, the internet, everybody's, you know, saying their piece, well, that sucker just needs to go. And
right.
And somebody, and it's hard to do without sounding, I guess, a little self-righteous, but when somebody's, you know, that person needs the Lord, you know, we need to pray for that person, and I've always convinced few times where I thought the person needs more before I thought what I'd love to see happen to him. It's
right.
Happened a few times. But I was just wondering, am I ever going to get to that level of spiritual maturity where my first instinct is always, how does God see that person? Would God rather see them smash, or would God rather see them repent?
Yeah.
You know, because as much as we may hate that person, as much as we really want to see him get it, God would rather have that person repent.
Yeah.
Second, no matter how much I think they deserve it.
It's the second person that always gets caught. Dennis Rodman made a career of it.
Yeah.
He punched him in the down in the zone, and the referees wouldn't see that. They just saw the reaction of the guy that he punched or whatever, and he just sit around like, "What's this? What's he doing?" You know. And it's the same. It's the same. I've never seen anybody who ever retaliated come out on the upper end. So
this. Might be an interesting affect our prayer regarding Putin. Putin, Russian president.
Yeah, if he got good and saved, how much would that solve?
Yeah.
You know, we want to take these people out. It's like, man, if they just found the Lord, how much easier would it be to deal with them?
Right. And so, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, though God at times takes out the wicked. You know, that just is a reality. Jump over to Proverbs chapter 24. You're jumping back, actually, going to the beginning. Psalms, Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 24. I'm going to start in verse 16 of chapter 24. Really, what I want to look at is the next... actually, you know, let's go to 15, verse 15 of chapter 24. It says, "Do not lie in wait, O wicked man, against the dwelling of the righteous. Do not destroy his resting place." I mean, that God is saying to those who are unrighteous people, those who are sinful people, don't destroy, you know, that which the people that are walking with the Lord. Verse 16, "For a righteous man falls seven times, rises again, but the wicked stumbles in a time of calamity." And these are principles that are laid out for us, all right? And then we come to verse 17. "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased, and he turn away his anger from him." What does that say?
That's cool, man. Exactly what Ben said.
I relate it to revenge. You know, when what did the Lord say? You know, vengeance is mine, said the Lord. Leave room.
Right.
Leave room for the Lord's,
vengeance.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, the point is, if you take revenge on somebody, don't expect God to come behind you, you know, for the leftovers, and redeem you if you've already taken it upon yourself. And that's what that makes me think of. You know, you're sitting there rooting for the guy to go down, and the Lord's like, he's not going to do it just because you think it should happen.
It really takes an attitude change, doesn't it? Verse 17.
Amen.
Don't rejoice when your enemy falls. You know, somebody's been harassing you. Maybe it's a supervisor, maybe it's a boss, maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's whatever. And they make your life absolutely, maybe it's a client, maybe it's one of the people you serve, and you know, that's all they do is make your life miserable. And they have, you would categorize them as an enemy. Right? And when they fall, don't rejoice with it. And that is tough. Because, you know, there's one aspect in which justice is to be played out. I mean, God is a God of justice. And he administers justice when certain things happen. Eventually, may not all be in this world and in this life. But ultimately, God will serve justice. So there's that sense of
wanting to see that justice is served, but then there's also this sense of not rejoicing when an enemy gets in a hard spot.
Schadenfreude, that's what they call that.
Oh, what?
Is rejoicing in the failure, not a Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
And we all love it.
It's called gloating.
Yeah, gloating. There, that's probably a real good translation for today. You know, they finally got theirs. What goes around comes around. You make your bed, you got to sleep in it. We have a lot of euphemisms about that, don't we?
What is it, though? Is it like the Muslims or the, whoever that they, or the Buddhists that, that believe in karma or whatever, something like that?
Buddhism is karma. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what they say, that you get what you get what you have coming.
So don't rejoice, and don't let your heart be glad. Man, that so that really takes the focus off the person who's created havoc for us, right? Because for me, that's going to take all of my effort right there, right there.
Well, like this person was a supervisor, and she made everybody
sick. Yeah.
And eventually he caught up with her. Now, we didn't, none of us went and complained about her. So we didn't cause her downfall.
Right.
But when she was dismissed, we were all relieved. Now, we didn't, you know, rattle.
Wine.
But we wasn't going to.
Well, okay, so there wasn't rejoicing, but there was relief. I don't know that that's necessary. Is that
the same thing?
I don't think it's a...
Well, there was another situation where this guy was put in a position. We saw at GE. I was there for many years, so I saw a lot coming up. And he put this guy over all of us instead of promoting any of us. And he, you know, budgeted everything revolved around budget. So he comes along and he'd say, hey, well, I'm going to cover that. Oh, don't worry about it. And he was playing like the big man, like, oh, you know, I got that. And so we were all like, we tried to tell him, you know, that's not how it works here. You have to really, you know, how he spent all of our money by June. He got let go really soon after, and we were trying to help.
Yeah.
But it was the pride. I think that overall, like, oh, you know, like you said, the swagger.
You had the swagger before you earned it. I like that phrase.
Justified, vindicated, take a little pleasure in that. It's like, I've been telling you the whole time. If you, okay, I'm just waiting.
You slaved your kid for me for a referral.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway, sorry.
You know, Chuck Swindoll was talking about that for the last couple of days, and it's hard. The only way to have that attitude, the only way to obey that edict of God is to have is to have the mind of Christ concerning love.
Yeah.
We have to be loving people and show Christ love, because our first instinct is always, you had that coming. Just, yeah. But
yeah,
to really love, no, it's so hard.
And Jesus had some things about what to do with an enemy, right?
Yes,
if your enemy is lacking, feed him.
What does he say?
Yeah.
What does he say about it?
Yeah, we got to treat him. We got to treat him right. Got to treat him as a, if your enemy's
love
your enemy. Yeah. Do good to those who hate you, despitefully use you. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to throw a monkey wrench in plan work for you. Now, we're supposed to do this, but Jesus took a whip.
What's with a butt? We're supposed to do this butt. Go ahead, Brenda.
I'm not there. Okay.
Oh, okay.
I'm just not lovely, but Jesus took a whip and cleansed the temple. So then, where do you draw the line with forgive somebody 70 times 7 without giving them a driver's license to sin?
Okay, good question.
Righteous.
Class, what do you think? Question? Okay, Jesus, we're supposed to kind of turn the other cheek, do that kind of thing, whatever this says here. But Jesus didn't do that when he cleansed the temple, so.
Because they were doing wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, because they were doing
wrong. But what if they're doing wrong to us?
Yeah.
It's righteous anger. Wrong. They're doing wrong.
It's on the situation.
Okay.
It's righteous anger. If someone is mistreating you or your children, you are to take and stand up for them. You're to do what's right for your family. And I think God holds you accountable to be that person to do just by your children or by your family.
Okay.
I think the location had a lot to do with it.
That's what.
Okay, what way?
Because he said, "In my Father's house."
Yes.
Yeah, I think that that's a significant difference. Yeah. Jesus was standing up for the temple that was being desecrated, yeah. And he was, and so he came in. You've turned it in. You know, it was. It's interesting. It was designed to be a house of prayer, but you have made it a place of merchandise. And so they didn't belong there. They were out of line being there. They were money changing in there. They were ripping the people off who were coming. They were charging double. You had to buy their, you know, if you wanted to do an offering, you had to buy the special sheep or goat that they had. You, even though you brought one, oh, that, you know, there's a blemish on that, though it's probably better than what they were giving you.
It wasn't about him.
Yeah,
it was not self-focused.
Yeah,
it wasn't about vengeance.
It wasn't self-focused.
It was about justice and glorifying God.
Right.
There's a big difference when we go after somebody for vengeance.
Because then you're doing it for yourself. Like,
that's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. It's like you said, sometimes you have to take somebody out. Sometimes a human government has the responsibility to put somebody to death.
Yeah.
And that's a righteous thing if it's done according to law and you know, God's law. But killing somebody because they deserve it and had it coming because I wanted you to make me feel better is not justice.
Yeah. Vigilante justice.
So government putting somebody to death rightly because they have taken life, you know, malice, that's justice. There, it's, you know, it has a lot to do with the condition of the heart.
I guess you do.
Motives. But yeah, I mean, Jesus did that. It wasn't about him. It was a zeal for God, and it was justice. And it was right.
Yeah. What about those people? What about those people? The people that are executing you, and what about the people even worse? What about the people performing abortions?
I don't think I have to stand for a Lord and answer to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the last part, verse 18, is kind of interesting. You know, don't rejoice, and there's a little incentive for us not to rejoice, because verse 18, lest the Lord sees it and be displeased. What is God seeing and being displeased about in verse 18?
Our heart.
Yeah, the fact that we're kind of a fix. And then what happens if the Lord is displeased because we are rejoicing over the fall of somebody who's been our enemy? What happens? Verse 18.
The Lord turns his anger away from you. Which sounds a little messed up. If the Lord's going to take action against somebody, why would he decide not to do it? Because I'm sitting over here going, you fell down. I mean,
because that's a human pride.
Well, yeah, but then the Lord, it's, okay, you know, seems, humanly speaking, like, that's my issue, and the Lord needs to deal with me on that. Why would that turn him away from dealing with this other person instead of just dealing with my wrong attitude toward them? I mean, if they had it coming, and God obviously felt they had it coming, and he was going to deal a little justice to them, why would he not deal justice to them? Because I'm being a jerk.
And let us gloat about it?
Well, but then he wouldn't have to deal with me.
Maybe that's his way of dealing with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Look how he did, David, with Bathsheba, with that baby. And said, because of what you've done, you're going to lose your firstborn. I mean, he paid a big penalty for it.
Yeah, so, I think that demands a heart change on us. And that's why I think where Isaiah, and we'll flip back there, where Isaiah is saying in chapter 16, where he is, both in 15:5 and then in 11:16, verse 11, where there is still this inward feeling. I think a classic illustration would be Jonah, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because Jonah was sent to go to Nineveh, capital of Assyria. So he was supposed to go from down here, up here to Nineveh, and he was supposed to preach to them. But as we know the story, Assyria is arch enemies. And God sends Jonah to go to Nineveh to tell them
that God, that if they don't repent, God's judgment's going to fall, which I find very fascinating, that God cares about how pagan cultures carry out, live out their life. I mean, that's what's going on here. Moab is not one of the considered to be a children of God, yet God cares how they live. All right? So Nineveh is a wicked city. Lots of people living there, big city. And so Jonah's supposed to head this way. He gets on a ship and goes that way.
He's like Columbus.
He didn't have the instructions of Columbus. And God gets a hold of him. And God gets a hold of him. He doesn't compel us to go against our will. He just makes us willing to go. That is God, right? Yeah, you know, it's like until finally, you know, Jonah says, "All right, I'm willing to go, but I don't want to go." I mean, isn't that fascinating? I'll go, but I don't want to do this. I'm a missionary, but I don't want to go. I don't want to tell them. There are arch enemies. And so God finally, you know, the story, God spits them out on, gives them a little bit of transportation, spits them out on dry land, and then he finally goes over to Nineveh and begins preaching, and he preaches that God's going to bring judgment. And I'll bet he was very enthusiastic about that message. God's going to wipe you out. Unless you repent. That was probably in the fine print, the last 30 seconds of his message. You know, judgment's coming. 30 seconds unless you repent. Then what happened?
They repented.
Okay. And what did Jonah do? Goes up and
says,
yeah. So here's an evangelist who sees a response to his message and he's angry about it. And so when he sits up there and he watches, and then God sends a little worm, you know, first of all, he sends plant grows, and then a little worm comes and chews on the plant, and the plant dies. God sends a Scirocco wind that withers it in just a small amount of time, plant dies, and Jonah is mad. And God says, God says to Jonah, do you have a right to be mad? And Jonah says, I absolutely do. And God says, you were concerned about that little plant that brought you some shade in the hot desert sun. I'm more concerned about, I forget how many, 200,000, 100,000, who don't know their right hand from their left, which normally that's understood to be children, so that you can multiply that almost by four. So that, you know, of the inhabitants of Nineveh, they repented, the king repented, they put on sackcloth and ashes. And Jonah's sitting up there on that hillside and he sees what happened. God does not strike him. He said, I knew you would do that. I knew you were a God of grace and mercy. And that you would strike him. That's the reason he didn't die in a belly of the fish, was because God's a God of grace and mercy. But that goes back to his job was to preach to the arch enemies, and he was mad that they repented and turned to the Lord.
It's 120,000.
120. Okay, there you go. They don't know the right from their left hand. So I find that to just be kind of an interesting sidelight for us today, as we live in a culture that really is loaded, don't we? In just so many different ways. That doesn't mean that we don't stand up for truth. Doesn't mean we don't stand up for right. You know, protect, and we are called, I mean, Linda, we are called to protect the innocent and the weak, the widows, etc. We have that calling to do that. But we live in a world that really is, we've got to be different. And I don't find that easy to do.
Didn't it say in the Bible that we'll probably lose our lives for it?
During tribulation period, yeah. Well, here, I mean, it certainly is getting a lot more
intense. Getting a lot more intense.
I think that attitude is so important because, I mean, you can lose your reward or lose the benefit of anything that you do by having the wrong motives. I mean, you do the right thing for the
right
reason. You protect somebody or you stand up and, you know, against corrupt authorities or whatever. Because you want to protect somebody or because you're glorifying God, that's one thing, but man, it gets so fouled up when you do those same things because you want the attention or because you want to be seen a certain way or because it's vengeance or pride or whatever, and it just gets twisted around. You can be doing the right thing all day long, doing it for the wrong reason. It's going to turn into a mess.
And it's hard. I think that's why it's so important for us to be involved in praying about God working through. Because I do think it's important for parents to be involved in the public school system. And some of you are. And that's a great thing. Others, you as Christian educators, are involved in the school system doing what you can in your capacity. Parents have perhaps a little more opportunity for expression. I don't know. But you're trying to do the right thing within your community for the children within the context. And so much of that can be twisted. They said this, they did that, they did, and so, but we're called to be salt and light. We're called to, and part of that is holding back evil.
Amen.
You know, so how do we live for Christ within this culture, holding back evil to the best of our ability without becoming obnoxious? You know, that we hear about those obnoxious people over there that shout and, we can, but I mean, it's a challenge.
I don't mind being obnoxious.
It's a gift. Spirit. I don't think it's a spiritual gift. No, I think how, you know, yeah, I think how we say things is really important, but ultimately we're not going to win. Let me back up on that. We need to stand for truth. We need to stand for righteousness. We need, I mean, you know, we get into the cultural issues of our day. And, you know, people say, well, you're going to be on the wrong side of history. No, we're going to be on the right side of history. I mean, God has spoken. His word hasn't changed. Biology hasn't changed. Marriage hasn't changed. You know, all of those things haven't changed. And it is interesting, even reading some of the secular people who are saying, you know, maybe 10 years down the road, we're going to look back and say, we really did a disservice to our young people because we're not helping them as we should have. We allowed them to make decisions, which they were not capable of making. And it goes back, God has been very plain, for example, male and female from the beginning. And so there are opportunities to say that. However, standing on a street corner with a placard yelling obscenities at the other side is not going to be very helpful. Yeah. You know? And I think it's probably going to be more one-on-one dialogue with people that we have a chance to some interaction. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're free to interject. I'm trying to figure the, you know, living this out in where we are today, which is a challenging. Yeah, Linda.
I've had the privilege of being raised by my grandmother a good bit of my life, and she would, as she got older. And I got married, and she would come and stay with me. She was really good at putting me in check. We had neighbors that had 5 kids, and it seemed like every time it was time to eat, I would have like these 5 little faces smashed up against my window. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, you know, there they are again. And she would just say, well, the Bible says, when you do to the least of them, you do unto him. And that's all she would have to say.
Right.
And I would just open the door. Are you guys hungry? You know. But those were the little things that she would constantly do to put me in check.
Right.
And to me, it was a privilege to have her in my life. And she would say things like, well, if I was getting angry about somebody, she would say, you know, wonder how their mother would feel. You know that's somebody's son or that's somebody's daughter. You know, how do you think that would make them feel that you're talking about them like that? So that has always been with me when I talk to other people and how I try to treat them. You know, how would I want someone to treat my daughter? How would I want someone to treat still how I can converse with people, you know, to have a good rapport with them.
Death by kindness.
Yes.
What's it say about
heaping coals of fires? Yeah, it depends on what your motivation is. But on and burn, baby, burn. I don't think that's what they mean by that.
I don't think humility is listed as one of the spiritual gifts, but it's sure, like, that's what you're describing, is just an amazing, humble spirit, that when you develop that, it sure looks like a spiritual gift. Because, I mean, I can think of a situation right now, without that humility, without that love of Christ, it changes like that. Because I remember a very specific situation which I am completely ashamed of. I was witnessing to somebody at work. And a very arrogant, you know, smart-mouthed person came over, inserted themselves into the conversation, and my attitude changed. Bam! Because they said something smart, Alec. And I gave them a decent answer. Not a great answer, a decent answer. They got uptight about it. Well, the next sentence out of their mouth dictated the next sentence out of my mouth. And immediately, whatever was happening, good, it was gone. And I mean, it happened in the blink of an eye. And I was, for the next 20 minutes, I was a person that I'm just completely ashamed of. I went back later that day and I apologized. So, my testimony was shot. And any Christ that I showed anybody during that interchange was not something anybody would be drawn to. I mean, I blew the whole thing. Because my attitude, because what I believe started out correctly about Christ changed me in the blink of an eye. Now it's about me. You've offended me.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to defend. And
yeah.
All the motive changed, and it was just vengeance and vindication and self-righteousness, and it changed so fast. But man, we have got to try to develop that sense of humility and pray for that, to have that mind of Christ, because otherwise, I mean, sometimes it's like the devil doesn't even have to try. It's like you give it to you so easy.
And you know, that's almost like, you know, praying for patience. You know, Lord, I want patience and I want it now. Well, you know, the trying of your faith produces patience. So, you know, you come back to how do you develop humility? It's like, well, it's kind of like you need sandpaper, you know, in that. I'm reminded, you know, with James and John, Boanerges, sons of thunder. You know, they got rejected. Remember, they got rejected in the town. And they said to Jesus, hey, how about we call down fire from heaven and just wipe out this?
And then
we read John in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. He's, you know, 80 years old. And my little children. And, you know, he just become from walking with Christ over that period. He was an immature believer. He's only about 2 years old in the Lord, you know. And now he's a mature believer. God's been at work in his life, you know, and my little children. And he, as a grandfather, a loving grandfather, as he writes some hard things. So, yeah.
I have a question. Okay, let's just say that, you know, we're human. You know, you do somebody wrong. Do you say sorry with your words, or do you say sorry with your actions? Because I've been in the courtroom. I know a guy who shot a guy. And I told him, you get up there, just listen to what he has to say. Don't say nothing. Just listen to him. You know? And, you know, he kept on talking to the judge, and then, you know, he said, I'm sorry, you know? And then he said, then he goes, well, it was an accident. And he says, well, which time was the accident? You shot the man 3 times.
It was an accident 7 times. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't think it's a pride thing. I just think it's more of an action thing that, you know, at least change your behavior and work with people in recovery. You know, sometimes you don't go up to somebody and make amends to them and try to relive the situation and bring it all up again.
I think it's both. I mean, you find that we are to confess to one another, we're to confess to the Lord. So that's mouth, but then actions. I don't think it's either or. It's like, do you want the right hand wing of your airplane or do you want the left hand wing? Well, hopefully you got both of them. And I think the actions demonstrate the validity of our words. So that would be. Well, I knew that chapter 17 was going to be way too long for us. We didn't quite get done, you know, the 16. So, did you have something you want to say, George?
Well, you know, you're talking about going up to people and talking to them, you know, and stuff like that. I don't do that just blatantly go up.
Yeah.
I've done this for probably 10 years. I order little cards, and one side has a calendar on it, the other has a verse. And I hand them out everywhere.
Oh, that's cool.
Banks, anywhere I'm at, I hand them out. Cash register. And it's really neat to see how it comes back because we went out Saturday night to Texas Roadhouse. And when I leave the tip, I leave a card. And but this time she came up and we handed it to her. And she looked and she goes, "Oh, I am so happy. My other one ran out, and I've been looking for getting another one for this year." I said, "Dad." She goes, "I don't know who gave it to." I said, "I'm probably the only one that's doing it, Randy. I give it to everybody." And she goes, "That's great." You know?
Where do you get them at?
Actually, I get them out of Current Magazine.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a little catalog.
That's cool.
And then I had one over McDonald's. I handed it to her, and she goes, "I still have mine from last year."
Wow.
So, I mean, it's...
The verse is still good. Yeah. Calendar, not so much.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of times that stimulates a conversation, too.
That's cool.
All right, thanks. Thanks for being here. We'll see you in the fall. Have a good summer. And we'll see you in September when summer is gone, as the song says. Thank you, Aaron.